Lewd's this year. I financed my habit selling heroin down at the junior high.
What is it, really?
Arnie's autograph, I said, immortalized on plaster.
His autograph?
I nodded. In duplicate. She found them, and 5 minutes later we were on the couch again, looking at two squares of plaster cast. They sat side by side on the glass-top coffee table, slightly ragged on the sides, a little the worse for wear. Other names danced off into limbo on one of them. I had saved the casts, had even directed the nurse on where to cut them. Later, I had cut out the two squares, one from the right leg, one from the left. We looked at them, silently. The signature, Arnie Cunningham, on the right. The signature, Arnie Cunningham, on the left. Lee looked at me, questioning and puzzled.
Those are pieces of your...
My casts, yeah.
Is it a joke or something?
No joke. I watched him sign both of them. Now that it was out, there was a queer kind of loosening, of relief. It was good to be able to share this. It had been on my mind for a long time, itching and digging away.
But they don't look anything alike.
You're telling me, I said. But Arnie isn't much like he used to be either. And it all goes back to that goddamn car. I poked savagely at the square of plaster on the left. That isn't his signature. I've known Arnie almost all my life. I've seen his homework papers. I've seen him send away for things. I've watched him endorse his paychecks, and that is not his signature. The one on the right, yes. This one, no. You want to do something for me tomorrow, Lee?
What?
I told her. She nodded slowly.
For us.
Huh?
I'll do it for us, because we have to do something, don't we?
Yes, I said. I guess so. You mind a personal question? She shook her head, her remarkable blue eyes never leaving mine. How have you been sleeping lately?
Not so well, she said. Bad dreams. How about you?
No, not so good. And then, because I couldn't help myself anymore, I put my hands on her shoulders and kissed her. There was a momentary hesitation, and I thought she was going to draw away. Then her chin came up, and she kissed me back, firmly and fully. Maybe it was sort of lucky at that, me being mostly immobilized. When the kiss was over, she looked into my eyes, questioning.
"Against the dreams," I said,
thinking it would come out stupid and phony smooth, the way it looks on paper, but instead it sounded shaky and almost painfully honest.
"Against the dreams,"
she repeated gravely, as if it were a talisman. And this time she inclined her head toward me, and we kissed again, with those two ragged squares of plaster staring up at us like blind white eyes, with Arnie's name written across them. We kissed for the simple animal comfort that comes with animal contact. Sure, that. And something more. Starting to be something more. And then we held each other without talking. And I don't think we were kidding ourselves about what was happening. At least, not entirely. It was comfort. But it was also good old sex. Full, ripe, and randy with teenage hormones. And maybe it had a chance to be something fuller and kinder than just sex. There was something else in those kisses. I knew it, she knew it, and probably you do too. That other thing was a shameful sort of betrayal. I could feel 18 years of memories cry out. The ant farms, the chess games, the movies, the things he had taught me, the times I had kept him from getting killed. Except maybe in the end, I hadn't. Maybe I had seen the last of him. And a poor, ragtag end at that on Thanksgiving night, when he brought me the turkey sandwiches and beer. I don't think it occurred to either of us that until then, we had done nothing unforgivable to Arnie. Nothing that might anger Christine. But now, of course, we had. Chapter 44. Detective Work. What happened in the next 3 weeks or so was that Lee and I played detective, and we fell in love. She went down to the municipal offices the next day and paid 50 cents to have two papers Xeroxed. Those papers go to Harrisburg, but Harrisburg sends a copy back to the town. This time, my family was home when Lee arrived. Ellie peeked in on us whenever she got the chance. She was fascinated by Lee, and I was quietly amused when, about a week into the new year, she started wearing her hair tied back as Lee did. I was tempted to get on her case about it and withstood the temptation. Maybe I was growing up a little bit, but not enough to keep from sneaking one of her yodels when I saw one hidden behind the Tupperware bowls of leftovers in the refrigerator. Except for Ellie's occasional peeks, we had the living room mostly to ourselves that next afternoon, the 27th of December, after the social amenities had been observed. I introduced Lee to my mother and father, my mom served coffee, and we talked. Elaine talked the most, chattering about her school and asking Lee all sorts of questions about ours. At first I was annoyed, and then I was grateful. Both my parents are the soul of middle-class politeness. If my mom was being led to the electric chair and bumped into the chaplain, she would excuse herself. And I felt pretty clearly that they liked Lee, but it was also obvious, to me at least, that they were puzzled and a little uncomfortable, wondering where Arnie fit into all this. Which was what Lee and I were wondering ourselves, I guess. Finally, they did what parents usually do when they're puzzled in such situations. They dismissed it as kid business and went about their own business. Dad excused himself first, saying that his workshop in the basement was in its usual post-Christmas shambles, and he ought to start doing something about it. Mom said she wanted to do some writing. Ellie looked at me solemnly and said, "Dennis, did Jesus have a dog?" I cracked up, and so did Ellie. Lee sat watching us laugh, smiling politely the way outsiders do when it's a family joke. "Split, Ellie," I said. "What do you do if I won't?" she asked. But it was only routine brattiness. She was already getting up. "Make you wash my underwear?" I said. "The hell you will," Ellie declared grandly, and left the room. "My little sister," I said. Lee was smiling. "She's great. If you had to live with her full time, you might change your mind. Let's see what you got." Lee put one of the Xerox copies on the glass coffee table where the pieces of my casts had been yesterday. It was the re-registration of a used car. 1958 Plymouth sedan, four-door, red and white. It was dated November 1, 1978, and signed Arnold Cunningham. His father had co-signed for him. Signature of owner, Arnold Cunningham. Signature of parent or guardian if owner is under 18, Michael Cunningham. "What does that look like to you?" I asked. "One of the signatures on one of the squares you showed me," she said. "Which one?" "It's the way he signed just after I got crunched in Ridge Rock," I said. "It's the way his signature always looked." "Now let's see the other one." She put it down beside the first. This was a registration slip for a new car, 1958 Plymouth sedan, four-door, red and white. It was dated November 1, 1957. I felt a nasty jolt at that exact similarity, and one look at Lee's face told me she had seen it too.
"Look at the signature," she said, quietly.
I did. Signature of owner, Roland D. LeBay. This was the handwriting Arnie had used on Thanksgiving evening. You didn't have to be a genius or a handwriting expert to see that. The names were different, but the writing was exactly the same. Lee reached for my hands, and I took hers. What my father did in his basement workshop was make toys. I suppose that might sound a little weird to you, but it's his hobby. Or maybe something more than a hobby. I think there might have been a time in his life when he had to make a difficult choice between going to college and going out on his own to become a toy maker. If that's true, then I guess he chose the safe way. Sometimes I think I see it in his eyes, like an old ghost not quite laid to rest, but that is probably only my imagination, which used to be a lot less active than it is now. Ellie and I were the chief beneficiaries, but Arnie had also found some of my father's toys under various Christmas trees and beside various birthday cakes, as had Ellie's closest childhood friend, Amy Carruthers, long since moved to Nevada and now referred to in the doleful tones reserved for those who have died young and senselessly. and many other chums. Now my dad gave most of what he made to the Salvation Army 400 Fund, and before Christmas the basement always reminded me of Santa's workshop. Until just before Christmas, it would be filled with neat cardboard cartons containing wooden trains, little tool chests, erector-set clocks that really kept time, stuffed animals, a small puppet theater or two. His main interest was in wooden toys. Up until the Vietnam War, he had made battalions of toy soldiers. But in the last 5 years or so, they had been quietly phased out. Even now, I'm not sure he was aware he was doing it. But like a good spray hitter, my dad went to all fields. During the week after Christmas, there was a hiatus. The workshop would seem terribly empty, with only the sweet smell of sawdust to remind us that the toys had ever been there. In that week, he would sweep, clean, oil his machinery, and get ready for next year. Then, as the winter wore on through January and February, the toys and the seeming junk that would become parts of toys would begin appearing again. Trains and jointed wooden ballerinas with red spots of color on their cheeks, a box of stuffing raked out of someone's old couch that would later end up in a bear's belly. My father called every one of his bears Owen or Olive. I had worn out 6 Owen bears between infancy and second grade, and Ellie had worn out a like number of Olive bears. Little snips of wire, buttons, and flat disembodied eyes scattered across the work table like something out of a pulp horror story. Last, the liquor store boxes would appear, and the toys would again be packed into them. In the last 3 years, he had gotten 3 awards from the Salvation Army, but he kept them hidden away in a drawer, as if he was ashamed of them. I didn't understand it then, and don't now. Not completely. But at least I know it wasn't shame. My father had nothing to be ashamed of. I worked my way down that evening after supper, clutching the banister madly with one arm and using my other crutch like a ski pole. "Dennis," he said, pleased but slightly apprehensive, "you need any help?" "No, I got it." He put his broom aside by a small yellow drift of shavings and watched to see if I was really going to make it. "How about a push, then?" "Ha ha, very funny." I got down, semi-hopped over to the big easy chair my father keeps in the corner beside our old Motorola black and white, and sat down. Plonk. "How you doing?" he asked. "Pretty good." He brushed up a dustpan full of shavings, dumped them into his waste barrel, sneezed, and brushed up some more.
"No pain?"
"No, well, some."
"You want to be careful of stairs. If your mother had seen what you just did..."
I grinned. "She'd scream, yeah."
"Where is your mother?"
"She and Ellie went over to the Renickies. Dinah Renicky got a complete library of Sean Cassidy albums for Christmas. Ellie is green."
"I thought Sean was out,"
my father said. "I think she's afraid fashion might be doubling back on her." Dad laughed. Then there was a companionable silence for a while. Me sitting, him sweeping. I knew he'd get around to it. And presently he did.
"Lee," he said, "used to go with Arnie, didn't she?"
"Yes," I said. He glanced at me, then down at his work again. I thought he would ask me if I thought that was wise, or maybe mention that one fellow stealing another fellow's girl was not the best way to promote continued friendship and accord. But he said neither of those things.
"We don't see much of Arnie anymore. You suppose he's ashamed of the mess he's in?"
I had the feeling that my father didn't believe that at all, that he was simply testing the wind.
"I don't know," I said. "I don't think he has much to worry about, with Darnell dead."
He tipped his dustpan into the barrel, and the shavings slid in with a soft flump.
"I doubt if they'll even bother to prosecute."
"No?"
"Not Arnie. Not on anything serious. He may be fined, and the judge will probably lecture him, but nobody wants to put an indelible black mark on the record of a nice young suburban white boy who was bound for college and a fruitful place in society."
He shot me a sharp, questioning look, and I shifted in the chair, suddenly uncomfortable. "Yeah, I suppose."
"Except he's not really like that anymore. Is he, Dennis?"
"No, he's changed."
"When was the last time you actually saw him?"
"Thanksgiving."
"Was he okay then?"
I shook my head slowly, suddenly feeling like crying and blurting it all out. I had felt that way once before and hadn't. I didn't this time either, but for a different reason. I remembered what Lee had said about being nervous for her parents on Christmas Eve, and it seemed to me now that the fewer the people who knew about our suspicions, the safer. For them. What's wrong with him?
I don't know.
Does Lee?
No, not for sure. We have some suspicions.
Do you want to talk about them?
Yes, in a way I do, but I think it would be better if I didn't.
All right, he said. For now.
He swept the floor. The sound of the hard bristles on the concrete was almost hypnotic.
And maybe you had better talk to Arnie before too much longer?
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
But it wasn't an interview I looked forward to. There was another period of silence. Dad finished sweeping and then glanced around.
Looks pretty good, huh?
Great, Dad.
He smiled a little sadly and lit a Winston. Since his heart attack, he had given the butts up almost completely, but he kept a pack around, and every now and then he'd have one, usually when he felt under stress.
Bullshit. It looks empty as hell.
Well, yeah.
You want a hand upstairs, Dennis?
I got my crutches under me. I wouldn't turn it down.
He looked at me and snickered.
Long John Silver. All you need is the parrot.
Are you going to stand there giggling or give me a hand?
Give you a hand, I guess.
I slung an arm over his shoulder, feeling somehow like a little kid again. It brought back almost forgotten memories of him carrying me upstairs to bed on Sunday nights after I started to doze off halfway through the Ed Sullivan show. The smell of his aftershave was just the same. At the top, he said,
"Step on me if I'm getting too personal, Denny, but Lee's not going with Arnie anymore, is she?"
"No, Dad."
"Is she going with you?"
I don't really know. I guess not.
Not yet, you mean?
Well, yeah. I guess so.
I was starting to feel uncomfortable, and it must have showed, but he pushed on anyway.
Would it be fair to say that maybe she broke it off with Arnie because he wasn't the same person anymore?
Yes, I think that would be fair to say.
Does he know about you and Lee?
Dad, there's nothing to know. At least, not yet.
He cleared his throat, seemed to consider, and then said nothing. I let go of him and worked at getting my crutches under me. I worked a little harder at it than I had to, maybe.
"I'll give you a little gratuitous advice," my father said, finally. "Don't let him know what's between you and her. And never mind the protestations that there isn't anything. You're trying to help him some way, aren't you?"
"I don't know if there's anything either Lee or I can do for Arnie, Dad."
"I've seen him 2 or 3 times,"
my father said.
"You have?"
I said, startled. "Where?" My father shrugged.
"On the street, downtown, you know. Libertyville's not that big, Dennis."
He what?
Hardly seemed to recognize me. And he looks older. Now that his face is cleared, he looks much older. I used to think he took after his father, but now...
He broke off suddenly.
"Dennis, has it occurred to you that Arnie may be having some sort of nervous breakdown?"
"Yes," I said, and only wished I could have told him that there were other possibilities.
Worse ones. Possibilities that would have made my old man wonder if I was the one having a nervous breakdown.
"You be careful," he said. And although he didn't mention what had happened to Will Darnell, I suddenly felt strongly that he was thinking of it.
"You be careful, Dennis."
Lee called me on the telephone the next day and said that her father was being called away to Los Angeles on year-end business and had proposed on the spur of the moment that they all go along with him and get away from the cold and the snow.
"My mother was crazy about the idea, and I just couldn't think of any plausible reason to say no," she said. "It's only 10 days, and school doesn't start again until January 8th.
"It sounds great," I said. "Have fun out there."
"You think I should go?"
"If you don't, you ought to have your head examined."
"Dennis?"
"What?"
Her voice dropped a little.
"You'll be careful, won't you? I've been thinking about you a lot lately."
She hung up then, leaving me feeling surprised and warm. But the guilt remained, fading a little now, maybe, but still there. My father had asked me if I was trying to help Arnie. Was I? Or was I maybe only snooping into a part of his life which he'd expressly marked off-limits, and stealing his girl in the process? And what exactly would Arnie do or say if he found out? My head ached with questions, and I thought that maybe it was just as well that Lee was going away for a while. As she herself had said about our folks, it seemed safer. On Friday the 29th, the last business day of the old year, I called the Libertyville American Legion post and asked for the secretary. I got his name, Richard McCandless, from the building's janitor, who also found a telephone number to go with it. The number turned out to be that of David Emerson's, Libertyville's good furniture store. I was told to wait a moment, and then McCandless came on, a deep, gravelly voice that sounded a tough 60, as if maybe Patton and the owner of this voice had fought their way across Germany to Berlin shoulder to shoulder, possibly biting enemy bullets out of the air with their teeth as they went.
"McCandless," he said.
"Mr. McCandless, my name is Dennis Gilder. Last August, you put on a military-style funeral for a fellow named Roland LeBay."
"Was he a friend of yours?"
"No, only a bare acquaintance, but..."
"Then I don't have to spare your feelings none,"
McCandless said, gravel rattling in his throat. He sounded like Andy Devine, crossed with Broderick Crawford.
"LeBay was nothing but a pure D. Sandy Cross son of a bitch, and if I'd had my way, the Legion wouldn't have had a thing to do with planning him. He quit the organization back in 1970. If he hadn't quit, we would have fired him. That man was the most contentious bastard that ever lived."
"Was he?"
"You bet he was. He'd pick an argument with you, then up it to a fight if he could. You couldn't play poker with the son of a bitch, and you sure couldn't drink with him. You couldn't keep up with him for one thing, and he'd get mean for another. Not that he had to go far to get mean. What a crazy bastard he was. You should pardon my Francais. Who are you, boy?"
For an insane instant, I thought of quoting Emily Dickinson at him. "I'm nobody. Who are you?" "A friend of mine bought a car from LeBay just before he died."
"Shit. Not that 57.
"Well, actually, it was a 58.
Yeah, 57 or 58, red and white. That was the only goddamn thing he cared about. Treated it like it was a woman. It was over that car that he quit the Legion. Did you know that?"
"No," I said. "What happened?"
"Ah, shit. Ancient history, kid. I'm bending your ear as it is, but every time I think of that son of a bitch LeBay, I see red. I still got the scars on my hands. Uncle Sam had 3 years of my life during World War II, and I never got so much as a Purple Heart out of it, although I was in combat almost all that time. I fought my way across half the little shitpot islands in the South Pacific. Me and about 50 other guys stood up to a bonsai charge on Guadalcanal. 2 fucking million Japs coming at us, hopped to the eyeballs and waving those swords they made out of Maxwell House coffee cans, and I never got a scar. I felt a couple of bullets go right by me, and just before we broke that charge, the guy next to me got his guts rearranged, courtesy of the Emperor of Japan. But the only times I saw the color of my own blood over there in the Pacific was when I cut myself shaving. Then,"
McCandless laughed,
"shit on toast. There I go again. My wife says I'll open my mouth too wide someday and just fall right in. What'd you say your name was?"
"Dennis Gilder."
"Okay, Dennis, I bent your ear, now you bend mine. What did you want?"
"Well, my friend bought that car and fixed it up, for sort of a street rod, I guess you'd say a showpiece."
"Yeah, just like LeBay,"
McCandless said, and my mouth went dry.
"He loved that fucking car, I'll say that for him. He didn't give a shit for his wife. You know what happened to her?"
"Yes," I said.
"He drove her to it,"
McCandless said grimly.
"After their kid died, she didn't get any comfort from him at all. None. I don't think he gave much of a shit about the kid either. Sorry, Dennis, I never could shut up. Talk all the time, always have. My mother used to say, 'Dickie, your tongue's hung in the middle and runs on both ends.' What did you say you wanted?"
"My friend and I went to LeBay's funeral," I said, "and after it was over, I introduced myself to his brother."
"He seemed like a right enough type,"
McCandless broke in.
"Schoolteacher, Ohio."
"That's right. I had a talk with him, and he did seem like a nice enough guy. I told him I was going to do my senior English paper on Ezra Pound."
"Ezra who?"
"Pound."
"Who the fuck's that? Was he at LeBay's funeral?"
"No, sir. Pound was a poet."
"A what?"
"Poet. He's dead, too."
Oh.
McCandless sounded doubtful. Anyway, LeBay, this is George LeBay. He said he'd send me a bunch of magazines about Ezra Pound for my report if I wanted them. Well, it turns out that I could use them, but I forgot to get his address. I thought you might have it.
Sure. It'll be in the records. All that stuff is. I hate being fucking secretary, but my year's up this July, and never again, know what I mean? Never fucking again.
I hope I'm not being a real pain in the ass.
No, hell no. I mean, that's what the American Legion's for, right? To help people. Give me your address, Dennis, and I'll send you a card with the info on it.
I gave him my name and address and apologized again for bothering him at his job.
Think nothing of it, he said. I'm on my fucking coffee break anyhow.
I had a moment to wonder just what it was he did at David Emerson's, which really was where Libertyville's elite bought. Was he a salesman? I could see him showing some smart young lady around, saying, "Here's one fuck of a nice couch, ma'am, and look at this goddamn settee. We sure didn't have nothing like that on Guadalcanal when those fucking stoned-out Japs came at us with their Maxwell House swords." I grinned a little, but what he said next sobered me quickly.
"I rode in that car, LeBay's, a couple of times. I never liked it. I'll be damned if I know why, but I never did. And I never would ride in it after his wife, you know. Jesus, that gave me the spooks."
"I'll bet," I said, and my voice seemed to come from far away. "Listen, what did happen when he quit the Legion? You said it had something to do with the car." He laughed, sounding a little pleased.
"You're not really interested in all that ancient history, are you?"
"Well, yeah, I am. My friend bought the car, remember?"
"Well, then I'll tell you. It was a pretty funny goddamn thing at that. A few of the guys mention it from time to time, when we've all had a few. I ain't the only one with scars on my hands. Getting right down to the bottom of it, it was sort of spooky."
"What was?"
"Oh, it was a kid's trick, but nobody really liked the son of a bitch, you know? He was an outsider, a loner."
"Like Arnie," I thought.
"And we'd all been drinking,"
McCandless finished.
"It was after the meeting, and LeBay had been making an even worse prick of himself than usual. Saw a bunch of us were at the bar, you know, and we could tell LeBay was getting ready to go home. He was getting his jacket on and arguing with Poochie Anderson about some baseball question. When LeBay went, he always went the same way, kid. He'd jump into that Plymouth of his, back up, and then floor it. That thing would go out of the parking lot like a rocket, spraying gravel everywhere. So this was Sonny Bellerman's idea. About four of us go out the back door to the parking lot while LeBay's shouting at Poochie. We all get behind the far corner of the building, because we know that's where he'll finish backing the car up before he takes off. He always called it by a girl's name. I told you, it was like he was married to the fucking thing. 'Keep your eyes open and your heads down, or he'll see us,' Sonny says. 'And don't move until I give you a go.' We were all sort of tanked up, you know. So about 10 minutes later, out he comes, drunk as a skunk, and feeling around in his chinos for his keys. Sonny says, 'Get ready, you guys, and keep low.' LeBay gets in the car and backs her up. It was perfect, because he stopped to light a cigarette. While he did that, we grabbed the back bumper of that Fury, and we lifted the rear wheels right off the ground, so that when he tries to pull out, spraying gravel all over the side of the building like usual, you know, he's only gonna spin his wheels and not go anywhere, you see what I mean?"
"Yeah," I said. "It was a kid's trick. We had pulled the same thing from time to time at school dances, and once, for a joke, we had blocked up Coach Puffer's Dodge so that the driving wheels were off the ground."
"We got some kind of shock, though. He gets his cigarette lit, and then he turns on the radio. That's another thing that used to drive us all fucking bug shit, the way he always listened to that rock and roll music like he was some kid instead of old enough to qualify for social fucking security. Then he put the tranny into drive. We didn't see it, because we were all hunkered down, so he wouldn't see us. I remember Sonny Bellerman was kind of laughing, and just before it happened, he whispers, 'They up, men?' And I whispers back, 'Your pecker's up, Bellerman.' He was the only one who really got hurt, you know, because of his wedding ring. But swear to God, those wheels were up. We had that Plymouth rear end 4 inches off the ground."
"What happened?" I asked. From the way the story was going, I thought I could guess.
"What happened? He pulled out, just like always. That's what happened. Just like all four wheels was on the ground. He spun gravel and ripped that rear bumper out of our hands and pulled about a yard of skin off with it. took most of Sonny Bellarmine's third finger. His wedding ring got caught under the bumper, you know, and that finger popped off like a cork coming out of a bottle. And we heard LeBay laughing as he went out, like he knew all along we was there. He could have, you know, if he'd gone back to use the bathroom after he finished shouting at Poochie, he could have looked right out the window while he whizzed and seen us standing around behind the building waiting for him. Well, that was it for him and the Legion. We sent him a letter telling him we wanted him out, and he quit. Just to show you how funny the world is, it was Sonny Bellarmine who stood up at the meeting right after LeBay died and said, we ought to do the right thing by him just the same. Sure, Sonny says. He says the guy was a dirty son of a bitch, but he fought the war with the rest of us, so why don't we send him off right? So we did. I don't know. I guess Sonny Bellarmine's a lot more of a Christian than I'll ever be.
You must not have had the back wheels off the ground, I said, thinking of what had happened to the guys who had screwed around with Christine in November. They had lost a lot more than some skin off their fingers.
We did, though, McCandless said. When we got sprayed with gravel, it was from the front wheels. I never to this day been able to figure out how he pulled that trick off. It's kind of spooky, like I said. Jerry Barlow, he was one of us who did it, always claimed LeBay threw a four-wheel drive into her somehow, but I don't think there's a conversion kit for something like that, do you?
No, I said. I don't think it could be done.
No, never do it, McCandless agreed. Never do it. Well, hey, I done jawed away most of my coffee break, kid. Want to get back and grab another half a cup before it all gets away from me? I'll send you that address if we got it. I think we do.
Thank you, Mr. McCandless.
My pleasure, Dennis. Take care of yourself.
Sure, use it, don't abuse it, right?
He laughed.
That's what we used to say in Fighting Fifth, anyway.
He hung up. I put the phone down slowly and thought about cars that still kept moving even when you lifted their driving wheels off the ground. Sort of spooky. It was spooky, all right, and McCandless still had the scars to prove it. That made me remember something George LeBay had told me. He had a scar to show from his association with Roland D. LeBay as well. And as he grew older, his scar had spread.
Chapter 45, New Year's Eve. I called Arnie on New Year's Eve. I'd had a couple of days to think about it, and I didn't really want to do it, but I had to see him. I had come to believe I wouldn't be able to decide anything until I actually saw him again for myself, and until I had seen Christine again. I had mentioned the car to my father at breakfast, casually, as if in passing, and he told me that he believed all the cars that had been impounded in Darnell's garage had now been photographed and returned. Regina Cunningham answered the phone, her voice stiff and formal. Cunningham residence? Hi, Regina, it's Dennis.
Dennis!
She sounded both pleased and surprised. For a moment, it was the voice of the old Regina, the one who gave Arnie and me peanut butter sandwiches with bits of bacon crumbled into them. Peanut butter and bacon on stone ground rye, of course.
How are you? We heard that they sprung you from the hospital.
I'm doing okay, I said. How about you? There was a brief silence, and then she said,
well, you know how things have been around here.
Problems, I said. Yeah.
All the problems we missed in earlier years, Regina said. I guess they just piled up in a corner and waited for us.
I cleared my throat a little and said nothing.
Did you want to talk to Arnie?
If he's there.
After another slight pause, Regina said, I remember that in the old days, you and he used to swap back and forth on New Year's Eve, seeing the new year in. Was that what you were calling about, Dennis?
She sounded almost timid, and that was not like the old full-steam-ahead Regina at all. Well, yeah, I said. Kid stuff, I know, but...
No, she said sharply and quickly. No, not at all. If Arnie ever needed you, Dennis, needed some friend, now's the time. He's upstairs now, sleeping. He sleeps much too much, and he's not... He hasn't...
Hasn't what, Regina?
He hasn't made any of his college applications, she burst out, and then immediately lowered her voice, as if Arnie might overhear. Not a single one. Mr. Vickers, the guidance counselor at school, called and told me. He scored 700s on his college boards. He could get into almost any college in the country. At least, he could have before this. This trouble. Her voice wavered toward tears, and then she got hold of herself again. "Talk to him, Dennis. If you could spend the evening with him tonight, drink a few beers with him, and just talk to him."
She stopped, but I could tell there was something more, something she needed to say and couldn't.
"Regina," I said. I hadn't liked the old Regina, the compulsive dominator who seemed to run the lives of her husband and son to fit her own timetable. But I liked this distracted, weepy woman even less. "Come on. Take it easy, okay?"
"I'm afraid to talk to him," she said finally. "And Michael's afraid to talk to him. He seems to explode if you cross him on some subjects. At first it was only his car. Now it's college, too. Talk to him, Dennis, please."
There was another short pause, and then, almost casually, she brought out the heart of her dread.
"I think we're losing him."
"No, Regina, hey, I'll get him," she said abruptly, and the phone clunked down. The weight seemed to stretch out. I crooked the phone between my jaw and my shoulder and wrapped my knuckles on the cast that still covered my upper left leg. I wrestled with a craven urge to just hang the telephone up and push this entire business away. Then the phone was picked up again.
"Hello?"
a wary voice asked, and the thought that burned across my mind with complete assurance was, "That's not Arnie."
"Arnie? It sounds like Dennis Gilder, the mouth that walks like a man," the voice said,
and that sounded like Arnie, all right. But at the same time, it didn't. His voice hadn't really deepened, but it seemed to have roughened, as if through overuse and shouting. It was eerie, as if I were talking to a stranger who was doing a pretty good imitation of my friend Arnie.
"Watch what you're saying, dork," I said.
I was smiling, but my hands were dead cold.
"You know," he said in a confidential voice, "your face and my ass, they're a suspicious resemblance."
"I've noticed the resemblance, but last time I thought it was the other way around," I said. And then a little silence fell between us. We had gone through what passed for the amenities with us.
"So what are you doing tonight?"
I asked.
"Not much," he said. "No date or anything. You?"
"Sure, I'm in great shape," I said. "I'm gonna go pick up Roseanne and take her to Studio 2000. You can come along and hold my crutches while we dance if you want." He laughed a little. "I thought I'd come over," I said. "Maybe you and me could see the new year in like we used to, you know?"
"Yeah,"
Arnie said. He sounded pleased by the idea, but still not quite like himself.
"Watch Guy Lombardo and all that happy-crappy. That'd be all right."
I paused for a moment, not quite sure what to say. Finally, I replied cautiously, "Well, maybe Dick Clark or someone. Guy Lombardo's dead, Arnie."
"Is he?"
Arnie sounded puzzled, doubtful.
Oh, yeah, I guess he is. But Dick Clark's hanging in there, right?"
"Right," I said.
"I gotta give it an 85, Dick. It's got a good beat, you can dance to it,"
Arnie said, but it wasn't Arnie's voice at all. My mind made a sudden and hideously unexpected cross-connection.
"Best smell in the world. Except maybe for pussy."
And my hand tightened down convulsively on the telephone. I think I almost screamed. I wasn't talking to Arnie. I was talking to Roland LeBay. I was talking to a dead man. "That's Dick, all right," I heard myself say, as if from a distance.
"How you getting over, Dennis? Can you drive?"
"No, not yet. I thought I'd get my dad to drive me over." I paused momentarily, then plunged. "I thought maybe you could drive me back if you got your car. Would that be okay?"
"Sure,"
he sounded honestly excited.
"Yeah, that'd be good, Dennis. Real good. We'll have some laughs, just like old times."
"Yes," I said, and then I swear to God, it just popped out. I added,
"Just like in the motor pool." "Yeah, that's right," Arnie replied, laughing. "Too much. See you, Dennis."
"Right," I said automatically. "See ya." I hung up, and I looked at the telephone, and presently I began to shudder all over. I'd never been so frightened in my life as I was right then. Time passes, the mind rebuilds its defenses. I think one of the reasons there is so little convincing evidence of psychic phenomena is that the mind goes to work and restructures the evidence. A little stacking is better than a lot of insanity. Later, I questioned what I heard, or led myself to believe that Arnie had misunderstood my comment, but in the few moments after I put the telephone down, I was sure.
LeBay had gotten in him. Somehow, dead or not, LeBay was in him, and LeBay was taking over. New Year's Eve was cold and crystal clear. My dad dropped me off at the Cunninghams at 7:15 and helped me over to the back door. Crutches were not made for winter or snow-packed paths. The Cunningham station wagon was gone, but Christine stood in the driveway. Her bright red and white finish sheened with a condensation of ice crystals. She had been released with the rest of the impounded cars only this week. Just looking at her brought on a feeling of dull dread like a headache. I did not want to ride home in that car, not tonight, not ever. I wanted my own, ordinary, mass-produced duster with its vinyl seat covers and its dumb bumper sticker reading Mafia Staff Car. The back porch light flicked on, and we saw Arnie cross toward the door in silhouette. He didn't even look like Arnie. His shoulders sloped. His movements seemed older. I told myself it was only imagination, my suspicions working on me. And of course I was full of bullshit, and I knew it. He opened the door and leaned out in an old flannel shirt and a pair of jeans.
"Dennis," he said. "My man."
"Hi, Arnie," I said.
"Hello, Mr. Gilder."
"Hi, Arnie," my dad said, raising one gloved hand. "How's it been going?"
"Well, you know, not that great. But that's all going to change. New year, new broom, out with the old shit, in with the new shit, right?"
"I guess so," my father said, sounding a little taken aback. "Dennis, are you sure you don't want me to come back and get you?" I wanted that more than anything, but Arnie was looking at me, and his mouth was still smiling, but his eyes were flat and watchful. "No, Arnie will bring me home, if that rust bucket will start, that is."
"Uh-oh, watch what you call my car," Arnie said. "She's very sensitive."
"Is she?" I asked.
"She is,"
Arnie said, smiling. I turned my head and called, "Sorry, Christine."
"That's better."
For a moment, all three of us stood there. My father and I at the bottom of the kitchen steps, Arnie in the doorway above us, none of us apparently knowing what to say next. I felt a kind of panic. Somebody had to say something, or else the whole ridiculous fiction that nothing had changed would collapse of its own weight.
"Well, okay," my dad said at last. "You two kids stay sober. If you have more than a couple of beers, Arnie, call me."
"Don't worry, Mr. Gilder."
"We'll be all right," I said, grinning a grin that felt plastic and false. "You going home and get your beauty sleep, Dad. You need it."
"Uh-oh," my father said. "Watch what you call my face. It's very sensitive."
He went back to the car. I stood and watched him, my crutches propped in my armpits. I watched him while he crossed behind Christine, and when he backed out of the driveway and turned toward home, I felt a little bit better. I banged the snow off the tip of each crutch carefully while standing in the doorway. The Cunninghams' kitchen was tile-floored. A couple of near accidents had taught me that on smooth surfaces, a pair of crutches with wet snow on them can turn into ice skates.
"You really operate on those babies,"
Arnie said, watching me cross the floor. He took a pack of Tipperillos from the pocket of his flannel shirt, shook one out, bit down on the white plastic mouthpiece, and lit it with his head cocked to one side. The match flame played momentarily across his cheeks like yellow streaks of paint.
"It's a skill I'll be glad to lose," I said. "When did you start with the cigars?"
"Darnell's," he said. "I don't smoke them in front of my mother. The smell drives her bug shit."
He didn't smoke like a kid just learning the habit. He smoked like a man who has been doing it for 20 years.
"I thought I'd make popcorn," he said. "Yup, for that."
"Sure, you got any beer?"
"That's affirmative. There's a 6-pack in the fridge and 2 more downstairs."
"Great." I sat down carefully at the kitchen table, stretching out my left leg. "Where's your folks?"
"Went to a New Year's Eve party at the Fassenbachs. When's that cast come off?"
"Maybe at the end of January, if I'm lucky."
I waved my crutches in the air and cried dramatically,
"Tiny Tim walks again! God bless us, everyone!"
Arnie, on his way to the stove with a deep pan, a bag of popcorn, and a bottle of Wesson oil, laughed and shook his head.
"Same old Dennis. They didn't knock much of the stuffing out of you, you shitter."
"You didn't exactly overwhelm me with visits in the hospital, Arnie."
"I brought you a Thanksgiving supper. What the hell do you want, blood?"
I shrugged. Arnie sighed.
"Sometimes I think you were my good luck charm, Dennis."
"Off my case, hosehead."
"No, seriously. I've been in hot water ever since you broke your wishbones. And I'm still in hot water. It's a wonder I don't look like a lobster."
He laughed heartily. It was not the sound you'd expect of a kid in trouble. It was the laugh of a man, yes, a man, who was enjoying himself tremendously.
He put the pan on the stove and poured Wesson oil over the bottom of it. His hair, shorter than it used to be, and combed back in a style that was new to me, fell over his forehead. He flipped it back with a quick jerk of his head and added popcorn to the oil. He slammed a lid over the pan, went to the fridge, got a six-pack, slammed it down in front of me, pulled off two cans and opened them, gave me one, held up his, I held up mine.
"A toast," Arnie said. "Death to the shitters of the world in 1979.
I lowered my can slowly. "I can't drink to that, man." I saw a spark of anger in those gray eyes. It seemed to twinkle there, like spurious good humor, and then go out.
"Well, what can you drink to, man?"
"About the college?" I asked quietly. He looked at me sullenly, his earlier good humor gone like magic.
"I should have known she'd fill you full of that garbage. My mother is one woman who never stuck at getting low to get what she wants. You know that, Dennis. She'd kiss a devil's ass if that's what it took."
I put my beer can down, still full. "Well, she didn't kiss my ass. She just said you weren't making any applications, and she was worried."
"It's my life,"
Arnie said, his lips twisted, changing his face, making it extraordinarily ugly.
"I'll do what I want."
"And college isn't it?"
"Yeah, I'll go. But in my own time. You tell her that, if she asks. In my own time. Not this year, definitely not. If she thinks I'm gonna go off to Pitt, or Horlicks, or Rutgers, and put on a freshman beanie and go bula bula at the home football game, she's out of her mind. Not after the shitstorm I've been through this year. No way, man."
"What are you gonna do?"
"I've taken off," he said. "I'm gonna get in Christine, and we're gonna motivate right the Christ out of this one-time table town. You understand?"
His voice began to rise, to become shrill, and I felt horror sweep over me again. I was helpless against that unmanning fear and could only hope that it didn't show on my face, because it wasn't just LeBay's voice now. Now it was even LeBay's face, swimming under Arnie's like some dead thing preserved in formalin.
"It's been nothing but a shitstorm, and I think that goddamn Junkins is still after me, full steam ahead, and he better watch out or somebody just might junk him."
"Who's Junkins?" I asked.
"Never mind," he said. "It's not important."
Behind him, the Wesson oil had begun to sizzle. A kernel of corn popped, punk, against the underside of the lid.
"I gotta go shake that, Dennis. You want to make a toast or not? Makes no difference to me."
"All right," I said. "How about to us?" He smiled, and the constriction in my chest eased a little.
"Us? Yeah. That's a good one, Dennis. To us. Gotta be that, huh?"
"Gotta be," I said, and my voice hoarsened a little. "Yeah. Gotta be." We clicked the bud cans together and drank. Arnie went over to the stove and began shaking the pan where the corn was picking up speed. I let a couple of swallows of beer slide down my throat. Beer was still a fairly new thing to me then, and I had never been drunk on it because I liked the taste quite well, and friends, Lenny Barong was the chief of them, had told me that if you got falling down, standing up, ralphing down your shirt shit-faced, you couldn't even look at the stuff for weeks. Sadly, I have found out since that isn't completely true. But Arnie was drinking like they were going to reinstitute prohibition on January 1st. He had finished the first can before the popcorn had finished popping. He crimped the empty, winked at me, and said,
"Watch me put it up the little tramp's ass, Dennis."
The illusion escaped me, so I just smiled noncommittally as he tossed the can toward the wastebasket. It banged the wall over it and dropped in.
2 points, I said. "That's right," he said. "Hand me another one, would you?"
I did, figuring what the hell. My folks were planning to see the New Year in at home, and if Arnie got really drunk and passed out, I could give my dad a call. Arnie may say things drunk that he wouldn't say sober, and I didn't want to ride home in Christine anyway. But the beer didn't seem to affect him. He finished popping the corn, dumped it into a big plastic bowl, melted half a stick of margarine, poured it over the top, salted it, and said,
"Let's go into the living room and watch some tube. What do you say?"
"Fine by me." I got my crutches, seated them in my armpits, which just lately felt as if they might be growing calluses, and then groped for the 3 beers still on the table.
"I'll come back for them," Arnie said. "Come on, before you break everything all over again."
He smiled at me, and for that moment, he was nobody but Arnie Cunningham, so much so that It broke my heart a little bit to look at him. There was some dorky New Year's Eve special on. Donnie and Marie Osmond were singing, both of them showing their giant white teeth in friendly but somehow shark-like grins. We let the TV play and talked. I told Arnie about the physical therapy sessions and how I was working out with weights, and after two beers I confessed that I was sometimes afraid that I would never walk right again. Not playing football in college didn't bother me, but that did. He nodded calmly and sympathetically through it all. I may as well stop right here and tell you that I have never spent such a peculiar evening in my life. Worse things were waiting, but nothing was so strange, so disjointed. It was like sitting through a movie where the picture is almost, but not quite, focused. Sometimes he seemed like Arnie, but at others he didn't seem like Arnie at all. He had picked up mannerisms I'd never noticed before, twirling his car keys nervously on the rectangle of leather to which they were attached, cracking his knuckles, occasionally biting at the ball of his thumb with his upper front teeth. There was that comment about putting it up the little tramp's ass when he tossed his beer can. And although he had gotten through five beers by the time I had finished my second, just downing them one after the other, he still didn't seem drunk. And there were mannerisms I had always associated with Arnie, which seemed to have disappeared completely. The quick, nervous pull at his earlobe when he was talking, the sudden stretch of his long legs ending with the ankles briefly crossed, his habit of expressing amusement by hissing air through his pursed lips instead of laughing outright. He did do that last once or twice, but more often he would signal his amusement in a string of shrill chuckles that I associated with LeBay. The special finished up at 11, and Arnie switched around the dial until he found a dance party in some New York hotel where they kept switching outside to Times Square, where a big crowd had already gathered. It wasn't Guy Lombardo, but it was close. "You really not going to college?" I asked.
"Not this year. Christine and I are going to head out for California right after graduation, at Golden Shore."
"Your folks know?"
He looked startled at the idea.
"Hell no. Don't you tell them either. I need that like I need a rubber dick."
"What are you going to do out there?"
He shrugged.
"Look for a job fixing cars. I'm as good at that as I am at anything."
And then he stunned me by saying casually,
"I'm hoping I can persuade Lee to come with me."
I swallowed beer the wrong way and began to cough, spraying my pants. Arnie slammed me on the back twice, hard.
"You okay?"
"Sure," I managed. "Just went down the wrong pipe."
"Arnie, if you think she's gonna come with you, you're living in a dream world. She's working on her college applications. She's got a whole file of them, man. She's really serious about it."
His eyes narrowed immediately, and I had a sinking feeling that the beer had betrayed me into saying more than I should have.
"How come you know so much about my girl?"
All of a sudden I felt as if I had been dropped into a long field that was full of loaded mines.
"It's all she talks about, Arnie. Once she gets started on the subject, you can't shut her up."
"Chummy, you're not moving in, are you, Dennis?"
He was watching me closely, his eyes slitted with suspicion.
"You wouldn't do anything like that, would you?"
"No," I said, lying completely and fully. "That's a hell of a thing to say."
"Then how do you know so much about what she's doing?"
"I see her around," I said. "We talk about you."
"She talks about me?"
"Yeah, a little," I said casually. "She said that you and she had a fight over Christine."
"It was the right thing." He relaxed.
"It was just a little thing, just a little spat. She'll come around. And there are good schools out in California if she wants to go to school. We're gonna be married, Dennis. Have kids and all that shit."
I struggled to keep my poker face.
"Does she know that?"
He laughed.
"No way, not yet. But she will. Soon enough. I love her. And nothing's gonna get in the way of that."
The laughter died away.
"What did she say about Christine?"
Another mine.
"She said she didn't like her. I think that maybe she was a little jealous."
It was the right thing, again. He relaxed even more.
"Yeah, she sure was. But she'll come around, Dennis. The course of true love never runs smooth, but she'll come around, don't worry. If you see her again, tell her I'm gonna call, or talk to her when school starts again."
I considered telling him that Lee was in California right now, and decided not to. And I wondered what this new suspicious Arnie would do if he knew I had kissed the girl he thought he was going to marry, had held her, was falling in love with her.
"Look, Dennis!"
Arnie cried, and pointed at the TV. They had switched to Times Square again. The crowd was a huge but still swelling organism. It was just past 11:30. The old year was guttering.
"Look at those shitters!"
He cackled his shrill, excited laugh, finished his beer, and went downstairs for a fresh six-pack. I sat in my chair and thought about Welch and Repperton, Trelawney, Stanton, Vandenberg, Darnell. I thought about how Arnie, or whatever Arnie had become, thought that he and Lee had just had an unimportant lover's spat, and how they would end the school year getting married, just like in those greasy love ballads from the nifty 50s. And, oh God, I had such a case of the creeps. We saw the new year in. Arnie produced a couple of noisemakers and party favors, the kind that go bang and then release a cloud of tiny crepe streamers. We toasted 1979 and talked a little more on neutral subjects, such as the Phillies' disappointing collapse in the playoffs and the Steelers' chances of going all the way to the Super Bowl. The bowl of popcorn was down to the old maids and the Bernie bottoms when I took myself in hand and asked one of the questions I had been avoiding. "Arnie, what do you think happened to Darnell?" He glanced at me sharply, then glanced back at the TV, where couples with New Year's confetti in their hair were dancing. He drank some more beer.
"The people he was doing business with shut him up before he could talk too much. That's what I think happened."
"The people he was working for?"
"Will used to say the Southern mob was bad," Arnie said, "but that the Colombians were even worse."
"Who were the..."
"The Colombians?" Arnie laughed, cynically. "Cocaine cowboys. That's who the Colombians are. Will used to claim they'd kill you if you even looked at one of their women the wrong way. And sometimes if you looked at her the right way. Maybe it was the Colombians. It was messy enough to be them."
"Were you running coke for Darnell?"
He shrugged.
"I was running stuff for Will. I only moved coke for him once or twice. And I thank Christ that I didn't have anything worse than untaxed cigarettes when they picked me up. They caught me dead bang, bad shit. But if the situation was the same, I'd probably do it again. Will was a dirty, scuzzy old son of a bitch, but in some ways he was okay."
His eyes grew veiled. Strange.
"Yeah, in some ways, he was okay. But he knew too much. That's why he got wasted. He knew too much. And sooner or later, he would have said something. Probably it was the Colombians. Crazy fuckers."
"I don't get you. And it's not my business, I suppose."
He looked at me, grinned and winked.
"It was the domino theory. At least, it was supposed to be. There was a guy named Henry Buck. He was supposed to rat on me, I was supposed to rat on Will, and then the big casino. Will was supposed to rat on the people down south that were selling him the dope and the fireworks and cigarettes and booze. Those were the people the cops really wanted, especially the Colombians."
"And you think they killed him?"
He looked at me, flatly.
"Them or the Southern mob, sure. Who else?"
I shook my head.
"Well," he said, "let's have another beer and then I'll give you a lift home. I enjoyed this, Dennis. I really did."
There was a ring of truth in that, but Arnie never would have made a dorky comment like, "I enjoyed this, I really did." Not the old Arnie.
"Yeah, me too, man."
I didn't want another beer, but I took one anyway. I wanted to put off the inevitable moment of getting into Christine. This afternoon it had seemed a necessary step to sample the atmosphere of that car myself, if there was any atmosphere to sample. Now it seemed a frightening and crazy idea. I felt the secret of what Lee and I were becoming to each other like a large, breakable egg in my head. "Tell me, Christine, can you read minds?" I felt a crazy laugh coming up my throat and dumped beer on it. "Listen," I said, "I can call my dad to come and get me if you want, Arnie. He'll still be up."
"No problem," Arnie said. "I can walk 2 miles a straight line, don't worry."
I just thought,
I bet you're anxious to be able to drive yourself around again, huh?
Yeah, I am.
There's nothing finer than being behind the wheel of your own car, Arnie said.
And then his left eye slipped down in a bleary old roué's wink.
Except maybe pussy.
The time came. Arnie snapped off the TV, and I crutched my way across the kitchen and worked into my own ski parka, hoping that Michael and Regina would come in from their party and delay things yet a while longer. Maybe Michael would smell beer on Arnie's breath and offer me a ride. The memory of the afternoon I had slipped behind Christine's wheel when Arnie was in LeBay's house, dickering with the old son of a bitch, was all too clear in my mind. Arnie had gotten a couple of beers from the fridge. For the road, he said. I considered telling him that if he got picked up DWI while he was out on bail, he'd probably go to jail before he could turn around. Then I decided I better keep my mouth shut. We went out. The first early morning of 1979 was deeply, clearly cold, the kind of cold that makes the moisture in your nose freeze in seconds. The snowbanks ringing the driveway glittered with billions of diamond crystals. And there sat Christine, her black windows called with frost. I stared at her. The mob, Arnie had said. The southern mob or the Colombians. It sounded melodramatic, but possible. No, more, it sounded plausible. But the mob shot people, pushed them out of windows, strangled them. According to legend, Al Capone had disposed of one poor sucker with a lead-cord baseball bat. But to drive a car over some guy's snow-covered lawn and slam it through the side of his house and into his living room? The Colombians, maybe. Arnie said the Colombians are crazy. But that crazy? I didn't think so. She glittered in the light from the house and the stars. And what if it was her? And what if she found out that Lee and I had our suspicions? Worse yet, what if she found out that we'd been fooling around?
You need help on the steps, Dennis?
Arnie asked, startling me. No, I can handle the steps, I said. You might have to give me a hand on the path.
No problem, man.
I got down the kitchen steps side saddle, clutching the railing in one hand and my crutches in the other. On the path, I set them under me, got a couple of steps, and then slipped. A dull thud of pain rumbled up my left leg, the one that still wasn't worth doodly squat. Arnie grabbed me.
Thanks,
I said, glad of a chance to sound shaky.
No sweat.
We got over to the car. Arnie asked if I could get in by myself. I said I could. He left me and crossed around the front of Christine's hood. I got hold of the door handle with one gloved hand, and a hopeless feeling of dread and revulsion swept over me. It wasn't until then that I really began to believe it, deep inside where a person lives, because that door handle felt alive under my hand. It felt like some living beast that was asleep. The door handle didn't feel like chrome steel. Dear Christ, it felt like skin. It seemed as if I could squeeze it and wake the beast up, roaring. Beast? Okay, what beast? What was it? Some sort of afreet? An ordinary car that had somehow become the dangerous, stinking dwelling place of a demon? A weird manifestation of LeBay's lingering personality? A hellish, haunted house that rolled on Goodyear rubber? I didn't know. All I knew was that I was scared, terrified. I didn't think I could go through with this.
Hey, you okay?
Arnie asked.
Can you make it?
I can make it, I said hoarsely, and jammed my thumb down on the button below the handle. I opened the door, turned my back on the seat, and let myself fall backward onto it, left leg extending stiffly. I got hold of my leg and swung it in. It was like moving a piece of furniture. My heart was trip-hammering in my chest. I pulled the door shut. Arnie turned the key and the motor rumbled to life, as if the engine were hot instead of dead cold. And the smell assaulted me, seeming to come from everywhere, but most of all, seeming to pour up from the upholstery, the sick, rich, rotten smell of death and decay. I don't know how to tell you about that ride home, that 3-mile ride that lasted no more than 10 or 12 minutes, without sounding like an escapee from a lunatic asylum. There is no way to be objective about it. Just sitting here and trying is enough to make me feel cold and hot at the same time, feverish and ill. There is no way to separate what was real and what my mind might have manufactured. No dividing line between objective and subjective, between the truth and horrified hallucination. But it wasn't drunkenness.
If I can assure you of nothing else, I can assure you of that. Any mild high I retained from the beer evaporated immediately. What followed was a cold, sober tour of the country of the damned. We went back in time, for one thing. For a while, Arnie wasn't driving at all. It was LeBay, rotting and stinking of the grave, half-skeleton and half-rotting spongy flesh, greenly corroded buttons. Maggots squirmed their sluggish way up from his collar. I could hear a low buzzing sound and thought at first it was a short circuit in one of the dashboard lights. It was only later that I began to think it might have been the sound of flies hatching in his flesh. Of course, it was winter time, but at times, there seemed to be other people in the car with us. Once I glanced up into the rearview mirror and saw a wax dummy of a woman staring at me with the bright and sparkling eyes of a stuffed trophy. Her hair was done in a 50s pageboy style. Her cheeks appeared to have been wildly rouged, and I remembered that carbon monoxide poisoning was supposed to give the illusion of life and high color. Later, I glanced into the mirror again and seemed to see a little girl back there. Her face blackened with strangulation, her eyes popping like those of some cruelly squeezed stuffed animal. I shut my eyes tight, and when I opened them, it was Buddy Repperton and Richie Trelawney in the rearview mirror. Crusted blood had dried on Buddy's mouth, chin, neck, and shirt. Richie was a roasted hulk, but his eyes were alive and aware. Slowly, Buddy extended his arm. He was holding a bottle of Texas Driver in one blackened hand. I closed my eyes once more, and after that, I didn't look into the rearview mirror anymore. I remember rock and roll on the radio. Dion and the Belmonts, Ernie K. Doe, the Royal Teens, Bobby Rydell. I remember that for a while, red styrofoam dice seemed to be hanging from the rearview mirror. Then for a while, there were baby shoes. And then there was neither one. Most of all, I remember seizing the idea that these things, like the smell of rotting flesh and moldy upholstery, were only in my mind, that they were no more than the mirages that haunt the consciousness of an opium eater. I was like someone who is badly stoned and trying to make some kind of rational conversation with a straight person, because Arnie and I did talk, I remembered that, but not what we talked about. I held up my end, I kept my voice normal, I responded, and that 10 or 12 minutes seemed to last hours. I have told you that it is impossible to be objective about that ride. If there was a logical progression of events, it is lost to me now, blocked out. That journey through the cold black night really was like a trip on a boulevard through hell. I can't remember everything that happened, but I can remember more than I want to. We backed out of the driveway and into a mad funhouse world where all the creeps were real. We went back in time, I have said, but did we? The present-day streets of Libertyville were still there, but they were like a thin overlay of film. It was as if Libertyville of the late 1970s had been drawn on saran wrap and laid over a time that was somehow more real, and I could feel that time reaching its dead hands out toward us, trying to catch us and draw us in forever. Arnie stopped at intersections where we should have had the right of way. At others, where traffic lights glowed red, he cruised Christine mildly through without even slowing. On Main Street, I saw Shipstad's jewelry store and the Strand Theater, both of them torn down in 1972 to make way for the new Pennsylvania Merchants Bank. The cars parked along the street, gathered here and there in clumps where New Year's Eve parties were going on, all seemed to be pre-60s, or pre-1958. Long portholed Buicks, a DeSoto Firelight station wagon with a body-long blue inset that looked like a checkmark, a 57 Dodge Lancer four-door hardtop, Ford Fairlanes with their distinctive taillights, each like a big colon lying on its side, Pontiacs in which the grill had not yet been split, Ramblers, Packards, a few bullet-nosed Studebakers, and once, fantastical and new, an Edsel.
"Yeah, this year's gonna be better," Arnie said.
I glanced over at him. He raised his beer can to his lips, and before it got there, his face had turned to LeBay's, a rotting figure from a horror comic. The fingers that held the beer were only bones. I swear to you, they were only bones. And the pants lay nearly flat against the seat, as if there was nothing inside them except broomsticks.
Is it?
I said, breathing the car's foul and choking miasma as shallowly as possible and trying not to choke.
It is,
LeBay said. Only now he was Arnie again, and as we paused at a stop sign, I saw a 77 Camaro go ripping past.
All I ask is that you stand by me a little, Dennis. Don't let my mother drag you into this shit. Things are gonna turn out.
He was LeBay again, grinning fleshlessly and eternally at the idea of things turning out. I felt my brains beginning to totter. Surely I would scream soon. I dropped my eyes from that terrible half-face and saw what Lee had seen. Dashboard instruments that weren't instruments at all, but luminescent green eyes bulging out at me. At some point, the nightmare ended. We pulled up at the curb in an area of town I didn't even recognize, an area I would have sworn I had never seen before. Tract houses stood dark everywhere, some of them three-quarters finished, some no more than frames. Halfway down the block, lit by Christine's high beams, was a sign which read, Maple Way Estates, Libertyville Realtors Sole Selling Agents, a good place to raise your family. Think about it.
Well, here you go, Arnie said. Can you make it up the walk yourself, man?
I looked doubtfully around this deserted, snow-covered development, and then nodded. Better here, on crutches, alone, than in that terrible car. I felt a large plastic smile on my face.
Sure, thanks. Negative perspiration,
Arnie said. He finished his beer, and LeBay tossed it into a litter bag.
Another dead soldier.
Yeah, I said. Happy New Year, Arnie. I fumbled for the door handle and opened it. I wondered if I could get out, if my trembling arms would support the crutches. LeBay was looking at me, grinning.
Just stay on my side, Dennis, he said. You know what happens to shitters who don't.
Yes, I whispered. I knew, all right. I got my crutches out and heaved myself up onto them, careless of any ice that might be underneath. They held me. And once out, the world underwent a swimming, twisting change. Lights came on, but of course they had been there all along. My family had moved into Maple Way Estates in June of 1959, the year before I was born. We still lived here, but the area had stopped being known as Maple Way Estates by 1963 or 64 at the latest. Out of the car, I was looking at my own house, on my own perfectly normal street, just another part of Libertyville, PA. I looked back at Arnie, half expecting to see LeBay again, taxi driver from hell with his benighted cargo of the long dead. But it was only Arnie, wearing his high school jacket with his name sewn over the left breast. Arnie looking too pale and too alone. Arnie with a can of beer propped against his crotch.
Good night, man.
Good night, I said. Be careful going home. You don't want to get picked up.
I won't, he said. You take care, Dennis.
I will. I shut the door. My horror had changed to a deep and terrible sorrow. It was as if he had been buried. Buried alive. I watched Christine pull away from the curb and head off down the street. I watched until she turned the corner and disappeared from sight. Then I started up the walk to the house. The walk was clear. My dad had scattered most of a 10-pound bag of haylight over it, with me in mind. I was three-quarters of the way to the door when a grayness seemed to drift over me like smoke, and I had to stop and put my head down and try to hold on to myself. I could faint out here, I thought dimly, and then freeze to death on my own front walk, where once Arnie and I had played hopscotch and jacks and statue tag. At last, little by little, the grayness started to clear. I felt an arm around my waist. It was Dad, in his bathrobe and slippers.
Dennis, are you okay?
Was I okay? I had been driven home by a corpse.
Yeah, I said. Got a little dizzy. Let's get in, you'll freeze your butt off.
He walked up the steps with me, his arm still circling my waist. I was glad to have it.
Is Mom still up?
I asked.
No, she saw the new year in, and then she and Ellie went to bed. Are you drunk, Dennis?
No.
You don't look good, he said, slamming the door behind us. I uttered a crazy little shriek of laughter, and things went gray again, but only briefly this time. When I came back, he was looking at me with tight concern.
What happened over there?
Dad.
Dennis, you talk to me.
Dad.
I can't.
What is it with him? What's wrong with him, Dennis?
I only shook my head, and it wasn't just the craziness of it, or fear for myself.
Now I was afraid for all of them. My dad, my mom, Elaine, Lee's folks. Coldly and sanely afraid.
Just stay on my side, Dennis. You know what happens to shitters who don't.
Had I really heard that? Or had it been in my mind only? My father was still looking at me.
I can't. All right, he said. For now, I guess. But I need to know one thing, Dennis, and I want you to tell me. Do you have any reason to believe that Arnie was involved some way with Darnell's death and the deaths of those boys?
I thought of LeBay's rotting, grinning face, the flat pants poked up by something that could only have been bones. No, I said, and that was almost the truth. Not Arnie.
All right, he said. You want to hand up the stairs?
I can make it okay. You go to bed yourself, Dad.
Yeah, I'm going to. Happy New Year, Dennis. And if you want to tell me, I'm still here.
Nothing to tell, I said. Nothing I could tell.
Somehow, he said. I doubt that.
I went up and got into bed and left the light on and didn't sleep at all. It was the longest night of my life, and several times I thought of getting up and going in with my mom and dad, the way I had done when I was small. Once I actually caught myself getting out of bed and groping for my crutches. I lay back down again. I was afraid for all of them. Yes, right. But that wasn't the worst. Not anymore.
I was afraid of losing my mind. That was the worst.
The sun was just poking over the horizon when I finally dropped off and dozed uneasily for 3 or 4 hours. And when I woke up, my mind had already begun trying to heal itself with unreality. My problem was that I could simply no longer afford to listen to that lulling song. The line was blurred for good.
Chapter 46. George LeBay again. On Friday, the 5th of January, I got a postcard from Richard McCandless, secretary of the Libertyville American Legion Post. Written on the back in smudgy pencil was George LeBay's home address in Paradise Falls, Ohio. I carried the card around in my hip pocket most of the day, taking it out occasionally and looking at it. I didn't want to call him. I didn't want to talk to him about his crazy brother Roland again. I didn't want this crazy business to go any further at all. That evening, my father and mother went out to the Monroeville Mall with Ellie, who wanted to spend some of her Christmas money on a new pair of downhill skis. Half an hour after they were gone, I picked up the telephone and propped McCandless's postcard up in front of me. A call to the operator placed Paradise Falls in area code 513, Western Ohio. After a pause for thought, I called 513 Directory Assistance and got LeBay's number. I jotted it on the card, paused for thought again, a longer pause this time, and then picked up the phone a third time. I dialed half of LeBay's number and then hung up. Fuck it, I thought, full of nervous resentment I could not recall ever feeling before. Enough is enough, so fuck it. I'm not calling him. I'm done with it. I wash my hands of the whole crappy mess. Let him go to hell in his own handcar. Fuck it. Fuck it, I whispered, and got out of there before my conscience could begin to bore into me again. I went upstairs, took a sponge bath, and then turned in. I was soundly asleep before Ellie and my folks came back in, and I slept long and well that night. A good thing, because it was a long time before I slept that well again. A very long time. While I slept, someone, something, killed Rudolph Junkins of the Pennsylvania State Police. It was in the paper when I got up next morning. "Darnell investigator murdered near Blairsville," the headline shouted. My father was upstairs taking a shower, Ellie and two of her friends out on the porch giggling and cawing over a game of Monopoly, my mother working on one of her stories in the sewing room. I was at the table by myself, stunned and scared. It occurred to me that Lee and her family were going to be back from California tomorrow. School would start again the day after, and unless Arnie, or LeBay, changed his mind, she would be actively pursued. I slowly pushed away the eggs I had scrambled for myself. I no longer wanted them. Last night it had seemed possible to push away the whole ominous and inexplicable business of Christine as easily as I'd just pushed away my breakfast. Now I wondered how I could have been so naive. Junkins was the man Arnie had mentioned New Year's Eve. I couldn't even kid myself that it hadn't been. The paper said he had been the man in charge of Pennsylvania's part of the Will Darnell investigation, and it hinted that some shadowy crime organization had been behind the murder. The Southern Mob, Arnie would have said, or the Crazy Colombians. I thought differently. Junkins's car had been driven off a lonely country road and battered to so much senseless wreckage.
"That goddamn Junkins is still after me full steam ahead. He better watch out or somebody might just junk him. Just stay on my side, Dennis. You know what happens to shitters who don't."
With Junkins still inside it. When Repperton and his friends were killed, Arnie had been in Philly with the chess club. When Darnell was killed, he was in Ligonier with his parents visiting relatives. Cast iron alibis. I thought he would have another for Junkins. 7. 7 deaths now, and they formed a deadly ring around Arnie Cunningham and Christine. The police could surely see that. Not even a blind man could miss such an explicit chain of motivation. But the paper didn't say that anyone was aiding the police in their inquiries, as the British so delicately put it. Of course, the police are not in the habit of just handing everything they know over to the newspapers. I knew that. But every instinct I had told me that the state cops weren't seriously investigating Arnie in connection with this latest murder by automobile. He was in the clear. What had Junkins seen behind him on that country road outside of Blairsville? A red and white car, I thought? Maybe empty. Maybe driven by a corpse. A goose ran squawking over my grave and my arms broke out in cold bumps. 7 people. Dead. It had to end. If for no other reason, then because maybe killing gets to be a habit. If Michael and Regina wouldn't go along with Arnie's crazy California plans, either of them or both of them might be next. Suppose he walked up to Lee in study hall period 3 next Tuesday and asked her to marry him, and Lee simply said no. What might she see idling at the curb when she got home that afternoon? Jesus Christ. I was scared. My mother poked in. "Dennis, you're not eating." I looked up. "I got reading the paper. Guess I'm not that hungry, Mom." "You have to eat, right, or you're not going to get well. Want me to make you oatmeal?" My stomach churned at the thought, but I smiled as I shook my head. "No, but I'll eat a big lunch." "Promise?"
"Promise."
"Danny, do you feel okay? You've looked so tired and peaked lately."
"I'm fine, Mom."
I widened my smile to show her how fine I was, and then I thought of her getting out of her blue Reliant at the Monroeville Mall, and 2 rows back was a white over red car, idling. In my mind's eye, I saw her walk in front of it, purse over her arm, saw Christine's transmission lever suddenly drop into drive. "Are you sure? It's not your leg bothering you, is it?"
"No."
"Have you taken your vitamins?"
"Yes."
"And your rose hips?" I burst out laughing. She looked irritated for a moment, then smiled. "You're a sassbox, Dennis Gilder," she said in her best Irish accent, which is pretty good since her mom came from the old sod. "And there's no kiver to you." She went back to the sewing room, and in a moment the irregular bursts of her typewriter began again. I picked up the newspaper and looked at the photo of Junkins's twisted auto. "Death car," the caption beneath read. "Try this," I thought. "Junkins is interested in a lot more than finding out who sold illegal fireworks and cigarettes to Will Darnell. Junkins is a state detective, and state detectives work on more than one case at a time. He could have been trying to find out who killed Moochie Welch,
Or he could have been... I crouched over to the sewing room and knocked.
Yes?
Sorry to bother you, Mom.
Don't be silly, Dennis.
Are you going downtown today?
I might be. Why?
I'd like to go to the library. By 3 o'clock that Saturday afternoon, it had begun to snow again. I had a slight headache from staring into the microfilm reader, but I had what I wanted. My hunch had been on the money, not that it had been any great intuitive leap. Junkins had been in charge of the hit-and-run that had killed Moochie Welch, all right. And he had also been in charge of investigating what had happened to Repperton, Trelawney, and Bobby Stanton. He'd have to be one dumb cop not to read Arnie's name between the lines of what was happening. I leaned back in the chair, snapped off the reader, and closed my eyes. I tried to make myself be Junkins for a minute. He suspects Arnie of being involved with the murders. Not doing them, but involved somehow. Does he suspect Christine? Maybe he does. On the TV detective shows, they're always great at identifying guns, typewriters used to write ransom notes, and cars involved in hit-and-runs. Flakes and scrapes of paint, maybe. Then the Darnell bust looms up. For Junkins, that's nothing but great. The garage will be closed, and everything in it impounded. Maybe Junkins suspects... what? I worked harder at imagining. I'm a cop. I believe in legitimate answers, sane answers, routine answers. So what do I suspect? After a moment, it came. An accomplice, of course. I suspect an accomplice. It has to be an accomplice. Nobody in his right mind would suspect that the car was doing it herself, so... So after the garage is closed, Junkins brings in the best technicians and lab men he can lay his hands on. They go over Christine from stem to stern, looking for evidence of what has happened, reasoning as Junkins would reason, trying to anyway. I think that there has to be some evidence. Hitting a human body is not like hitting a feather pillow. Hitting the crash barrier out at Squantic Hills is not like hitting a feather pillow either. So what do they find, these experts in vehicular homicide? Nothing. They find no dents, no touch-up repainting, no bloodstains. They find no embedded brown paint flakes from the Squantic Hills road barrier that was broken off. In short, Junkins finds absolutely no evidence that Christine was used in either crime. Now jump ahead to Darnell's murder. Does Junkins hustle over to the garage the next day to check on Christine? I would if it was me. The side of a house isn't a feather pillow either, and a car that has just crashed through one must have sustained major damage, damage that simply couldn't have been repaired overnight. And when he gets there, what does he find? Only Christine, without so much as a ding in her fender. That led to another deduction, one that explained why Junkins had never put a stakeout on the car. I hadn't been able to understand that because he must have suspected that Christine was involved, but in the end, logic had ruled him. And perhaps it had killed him as well. Junkins hadn't put a stakeout on her because Christine's alibi, while mute, was every bit as ironclad as those of her owner. If he had inspected Christine immediately following the murder of Will Darnell, Junkins must have concluded that the car could not have been involved, no matter how persuasive the evidence to the contrary seemed. Not a scratch on her. And why not? It was just that Junkins hadn't had all the facts. I thought about the odometer that ran backward, and Arnie saying, just a glitch. I thought of the nest of cracks in the windshield that had seemed to grow smaller and draw inward, as if they were running backward, too. I thought of the haphazard replacement of parts that seemed totally without rhyme or reason. Last of all, I thought of my nightmare ride home on Sunday night. Old cars that looked new clumped up at the curb outside houses where parties were going on. The Strand Theater intact again in all of its yellow brick solidity. The half-built development that had been completed and occupied by Libertyville suburbanites 20 years ago. Just a glitch. I thought that not knowing about that glitch was what had really killed Rudolph Junkins. Because, look, if you own a car long enough, things wear out, no matter how well you take care of it. And they usually go randomly. A car comes off the assembly line like a newborn baby, and just like a newborn, it starts rolling down an Indian gauntlet of years. The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune crack a battery here, bust a tie rod there, freeze a bearing somewhere else. The carburetor float sticks, a tire blows, there's an electrical short, the upholstery starts getting ratty. It's like a movie, and if you could run the film backward.
Will there be anything else, sir?
the records clerk asked from behind me, and I nearly screamed. Mom was waiting for me in the main lobby, and she chatted most of the way home about her writing and her new class, which was disco dancing. I nodded and replied in most of the right places, and I thought that if Junkins had brought in his technicians, his high-powered auto specialists from Harrisburg, they had probably overlooked an elephant while looking for a needle. I couldn't blame them either. Cars just don't run backward, like a movie in reverse. And there are no such things as ghosts or revenants or demons preserved in Quaker State motor oil. Believe in one? Believe in all, I thought, and shuddered.
"Want to turn up the heater, Denny?" Mom asked brightly.
"Would you, Mom?" I thought of Lee, who was due back tomorrow. Lee, with her lovely face, enhanced by those slanting, almost cruel cheekbones, her young and sweetly luscious figure that had not yet been marred by the forces of time or gravity. Like that long-ago Plymouth that had rolled out of Detroit on a carrier in 1957, she was, in a sense, still under warranty. Then I thought of LeBay, who was dead and yet undead, and I thought of his lust. But was it lust, or just a need to spoil things? I thought of Arnie saying with calm assurance that they were going to be married. And then, with a helpless clarity, I saw their wedding night. I saw her looking up into the darkness of some motel room and seeing a rotting, grinning corpse poised over her. I heard her screams as Christine, a Christine still festooned with crepe streamers and soaped-on just-married signs, waited faithfully outside the closed and locked door. Christine, or the terrible female force that animated her, would know Lee wouldn't last long, and she, Christine, would be around when Lee was gone. I closed my eyes to block the images out, but that only intensified them. It had begun with Lee wanting Arnie, and had progressed logically enough to Arnie wanting her back. But it hadn't stopped there, had it? Because now LeBay had Arnie, and he wanted Lee. But he wasn't going to have her, not if I could help it. That night, I called George LeBay. "Yes, Mr. Gilder," he said. He sounded older, tireder. "I remember you very well. I talked your ear off in front of my unit in what I believe may have been the most depressing motel in the universe. What can I do for you?" He sounded as though he hoped I wouldn't require too much. I hesitated. Did I tell him that his brother had come back from the dead, that not even the grave had been able to end his hate of the shitters? Did I tell him he had possessed my friend, had picked him out as unerringly as Arnie had picked out Christine? Did we talk about mortality and time and rancid love? "Mr. Gilder, are you there?" "I've got a problem, Mr. LeBay, and I don't know exactly how to tell you about it. It concerns your brother." Something new came into his voice then, something tight and controlled. "I don't know what sort of a problem you could have that would concern him. Raleigh's dead." "That's just it." Now I was unable to control my own voice. It trembled up to a higher octave and then drifted back down again. "I don't think he is." "What are you talking about?" His voice was taut, accusing and fearful. "If this is your idea of a joke, I assure you it's in the poorest possible taste." "No joke. Just let me tell you some of the stuff that's happened since your brother died. Mr. Gilder, I have several sets of papers to correct, and a novel I want to finish, and I really don't have time to indulge in..." "Please," I said. "Please, Mr. LeBay, please help me. And help my friend." There was a long, long pause, and then LeBay sighed. "Tell your tale," he said, and then, after a brief pause, he added, "God damn you." I passed the story along to him by way of modern long-distance cable. I can imagine my voice going through computerized switching stations full of miniaturized circuits under snow-blanketed wheat fields and finally into the ear of this man. I told him about Arnie's trouble with Repperton,
Buddy's expulsion and revenge. I told him about the death of Moochie Welch, what had happened at Squantic Hills, what had happened during the Christmas Eve storm. I told him about windshield cracks that seemed to run backward and an odometer that did for sure. I told him about the radio that seemed to receive only WDIL, the oldies station, no matter where you set it. That brought a soft grunt of surprise from George LeBay. I told him about the handwriting on my casts, and how the one Arnie had done on Thanksgiving night matched his brother's signature on Christine's original registration form. I told him about Arnie's constant use of the word shitters, the way he had started combing his hair like Fabian, or one of those other 50s greaseballs. I told him everything, in fact, except what had happened to me on my ride home early on New Year's morning. I had intended to, but I simply could not do it. I never let that out of myself until I wrote all of this down 4 years later. When I finished, there was a silence on the line. "Mr. LeBay, are you still there?" "I'm here," he said finally. "Mr. Gilder, Dennis, I don't intend to offend you, but you must realize that what you are suggesting goes far beyond any possible psychic phenomena and extends into..." He trailed off. "Madness?" "That isn't the word I would have used. From what you say, you were involved in a terrible football accident. You were in the hospital for 2 months and in great pain for some of that time. Now, isn't it possible that your imagination..." "Mr. LeBay," I said, "did your brother ever have a saying about the little tramp?" "What?" "The little tramp. Like when you throw a ball of paper at the wastebasket and hit it, you say 2 points. Only instead of that, watch me put it up the little tramp's ass. Did your brother ever say that?" "How did you know that?" And then, without giving me time to answer, "He used the phrase on one of the occasions when you met him, didn't he?" "No." "Mr. Gilder, you're a liar." I said nothing. I was shaking, weak-kneed. No adult had ever said that to me in my whole life. "Dennis, I'm sorry, but my brother is dead. He was an unpleasant, possibly even an evil human being, but he is dead, and all of these morbid fancies and fantasies..." "Who was the little tramp?" I managed. Silence. "Was it Charlie Chaplin?" I didn't think he was going to reply at all. Then, at last, heavily, he said, "Only at second hand." He meant Hitler. There was a passing resemblance between Hitler and Chaplin's little tramp. Chaplin made a movie called The Great Dictator. You've probably never even seen it. It was a common enough name for him during the war years, at any rate. He would be much too young to remember. But it means nothing. It was my turn to remain silent. "It means nothing," he shouted. "Nothing. It's vapors and suggestions. Nothing more. You must see this." "There's 7 people dead over here in western Pennsylvania," I said. "That's not just vapors. There are the signatures on my casts. They're not vapors either. I saved them, Mr. LeBay. Let me send them to you. Look at them and tell me if one of them isn't your brother's handwriting. It could be a knowing or unknowing forgery. If you believe that, get a handwriting expert. I'll pay for it." "You could do that yourself." "Mr. LeBay," I said, "I don't need any more convincing." "But what do you want from me? To share your fantasy? I won't do that. My brother is dead. His car is just a car." He was lying. I felt it. Even through the telephone, I felt it. "I want you to explain something you said to me that night we talked."
"What would that be?"
He sounded wary. I licked my lips. "You said he was obsessed and angry, but he wasn't a monster. At least you said you didn't think he was. Then it seemed like you changed the subject completely. But the more I think about it, the more I think you didn't change the subject at all. The next thing you said was that he never put a mark on either of them."
"Dennis, really, look, if you were going to say something, for Christ's sake, say it now," I cried.
My voice cracked. I wiped my forehead, and my hand came away slimy with sweat.
"This is no easier for me than it is for you. Arnie's fixated on this girl. Her name is Lee Cabot, only I don't think it's Arnie who's fixated on her at all. I think it's your brother, your dead brother. Now talk to me, please."
He sighed.
"Talk to you,"
he said. Talk to you. To talk about these old events. No, these old suspicions. That would be almost the same as to shake a sleeping fiend, Dennis. Please, I know nothing.
I could have told him the fiend was already awake, but he knew that.
Tell me what you suspect.
I'll call you back. Mr. LeVay, please, I'll call you back, he said. I've got to call my sister, Marcia, in Colorado.
If it will help, I'll call...
No. She would never talk to you. We've only talked of it to each other once or twice, if that. I hope your conscience is clear on this matter, Dennis. Because you are asking us to rip open old scars and make them bleed again. So I'll ask you once more. How sure are you?
Sure,
I whispered. I'll call you back, he said, and hung up. 15 minutes went past, then 20. I went around the room on my crutches, unable to sit still. I looked out the window at the wintry street, a study in blacks and whites. Twice I went to the telephone and didn't pick it up, afraid he would be trying to get me at the same time, even more afraid that he wouldn't call back at all. The third time, just as I put my hand on it, it rang. I jerked back as if stung, and then scooped it up.
Hi?
Ellie's breathless voice said from downstairs. Donna?
Is Dennis Gilder?
LeBay's voice began, sounding older and more broken than ever.
I've got it, Ellie,
I said.
Well, who cares?
Ellie said pertly, and hung up.
Hello, Mr. LeBay, I said.
My heart was thudding hard.
I spoke to her, he said heavily. She tells me only to use my own judgment. But she is frightened. Together, you and I have conspired to frighten an old lady who has never hurt anyone. And has nothing whatever to do with this.
In a good cause, I said.
Is it?
If I didn't think so, I wouldn't have called you, I said.
Are you going to talk to me or not, Mr. LeBay?
Yes, he said. To you, but to no one else. If you should tell someone else, I would deny it, you understand?
Yes.
Very well, he sighed. In our conversation last summer, Dennis, I told you one lie about what happened, and one lie about what Marcy and I felt about it. We lied to ourselves. If it hadn't been for you, I think we could have continued to lie to ourselves about that incident by the highway for the rest of our lives.
The little girl? LeBay's daughter?
I was holding the phone tightly, squeezing it.
Yes, he said heavily. Rita. What really happened when she choked? My mother used to call Raleigh her changeling, LeBay said. Did I tell you that?
No.
No, of course not. I told you I thought your friend would be happier if he got rid of the car, but there is only so much a person can say in defense of one's beliefs, because the irrational, it creeps in.
He paused. I didn't prompt him. He would tell or he wouldn't. It was as simple as that. My mother said he was a perfectly good baby until he was 6 months old. And then... she said that was when Puck came. She said Puck took her good baby for one of his jokes and replaced him with a changeling. She laughed when she said it. But she never said it when Raleigh was around to hear. And her eyes never laughed, Dennis. I think... it was her only explanation for what he was, for why he was so untouchable in his rage, so single-minded in his few simple purposes. There was a boy, I have forgotten his name, a bigger boy who thrashed Raleigh 3 or 4 times, a bully. He would start on Raleigh's clothes and ask him if he'd worn his underpants 1 month or 2 this time, and Raleigh would fight him and curse him and threaten him, and the bully would laugh at him and hold him off with his longer arms and punch him until he was tired or until Raleigh's nose was bleeding. And then Raleigh would sit there on the corner, smoking a cigarette and crying with blood and snot drying on his face. And if Drew or I came near him, he would beat us to within an inch of our lives. That bully's house burned down one night, Dennis. The bully and the bully's father and the bully's little brother were killed.
the bully's sister was horribly burned. It was supposed to have been the stove in the kitchen, and maybe it was. But the fire sirens woke me up, and I was still awake when Raleigh came up the ivy trellis and into the room I shared with him. There was soot on his forehead, and he smelled of gasoline. He saw me lying there with my eyes open, and he said, "If you tell Georgie, I'll kill you." And ever since that night, Dennis, I've tried to tell myself that he meant if I told he had been out watching the fire. And maybe that was all it was. My mouth was dry. There seemed to be a lead ball in my stomach. The hairs along the nape of my neck felt like dry quills.
"How old was your brother then?"
I asked hoarsely. "Not quite 13, LeBay said, with terrible false calm. One winter day, about a year later, there was a fight during a hockey game, and a fellow named Randy Throgmorton laid open Raleigh's head with his stick, knocked him senseless. We got him to old Dr. Farner. Raleigh had come around by then, but he was still groggy, and Farner put a dozen stitches in his scalp. A week later, Randy Throgmorton fell through the ice on Palmer Pond and was drowned. He had been skating in an area clearly marked with thin ice signs. Apparently.
Are you saying your brother killed these people? Are you leading up to telling me that LeBay killed his own daughter?
Not that he killed her, Dennis. Never think that. She choked to death. What I am suggesting is that he may have let her die.
You said he turned her over, punched her, tried to make her vomit.
That's what Raleigh told me at the funeral, George said.
Then what?
Marcia and I talked it over later. Only that once, you understand, over dinner that night. Raleigh told me, "I picked her up by her Buster Browns and tried to whack that son of a bitch out of there, Georgie, but it was stuck down fast." And what Veronica told Marcia was, "Raleigh picked her up by her shoes and tried to whack whatever was choking her out of there, but it was stuck down fast." They told exactly the same story, in exactly the same words. And you know what that made me think of?
No.
It made me think of Raleigh climbing in the bedroom window and whispering to me, "If you tell Georgie, I'll kill you."
But why? Why would he...
Later, Veronica wrote Marcia a letter and hinted that Raleigh had made no real effort to save their daughter, and that, at the very end, he put her back in the car. So she would be out of the sun, he said, but in her letter, Veronica said she thought Raleigh wanted her to die in the car.
I didn't want to say it, but I had to. Are you suggesting that your brother offered his daughter up as some kind of a human sacrifice?
There was a long, thinking, dreadful pause. Not in any conscious way, no, LeBay said. Not any more than I am suggesting that he consciously murdered her. If you had known my brother, you would know how ridiculous it is to suspect him of witchcraft or sorcery or trafficking with demons. He believed in nothing beyond his own senses, except, I suppose, for his own will. I'm suggesting that he might have had some intuition, or that he might have been directed to do what he did. My mother said he was a changeling.
And Veronica?
I don't know, he said. The police verdict was suicide, even though there was no note. It may well have been, but the poor woman had made some friends in town, and I have often wondered if perhaps she had hinted to some of them, as she had to Marcia, that Rita's death was not quite as she and Raleigh had reported. I have wondered if Raleigh found out. "If you tell Georgie, I'll kill you." There's no proof one way or the other, of course. But I've wondered why she would do it the way she did. And I've wondered
how a woman who didn't know the slightest thing about cars would know enough to get the hose and attach it to the exhaust pipe and put it in through the window. I try not to wonder about those things. They keep me awake at night. I thought about what he had said, and about the things he hadn't said, the things he had left between the lines. Intuitive, he had said, so single-minded in his few simple purposes, he had said. Suppose Roland LeBay had understood in some way he wouldn't even admit to himself that he was investing his Plymouth with some supernatural power. And suppose he had only been waiting for the right inheritor to come along. And now,
does that answer your questions, Dennis?
I think it does, I said slowly.
What are you going to do?
I think you know that.
Destroy the car.
I'm going to try, I said, and then looked over at my crutches, leaning against the wall. My goddamn crutches.
You may destroy your friend as well.
I may save him, I said. Quietly, George LeBay said,
I wonder if that is still possible.
Chapter 47. The Betrayal. I kissed her. Her arm slipped around my neck. One of her cool hands pressed lightly against the back of my head. There was no more question for me about what was going on, and when she pulled slightly away from me, her eyes half closed, I could see there was no question for her, either.
Dennis, she murmured, and I kissed her again. Our tongues touched, gently. For a moment her kiss intensified. I could feel the passion those high cheekbones hinted at. Then she gasped a little and drew back. That's enough, she said. We'll be arrested for indecent exposure or something.
It was January 18th. We were parked in the lot behind the local Kentucky Fried, the remains of a pretty decent chicken dinner spread around us. We were in my duster, and that alone was something of an occasion for me. It was my first time behind the wheel since the accident. Just that morning, the doctor had removed the huge cast on my left leg and replaced it with a brace. His warning to stay off it was stern, but I could tell he was feeling good about the way things were going for me. My recovery was about a month ahead of schedule. He put it down to superior technique, my mother to positive thinking in chicken soup, Coach Puffer to rose hips. Me? I thought Lee Cabot had a lot to do with it.
We have to talk, she said.
No, let's make out some more, I said.
Talk now, make out later.
Has he started again?
She nodded. In the almost 2 weeks since my telephone conversation with LeBay, the first 2 weeks of winter term, Arnie had been working at making a rapprochement with Lee, working at it with an intensity that scared both of us. I had told her about my talk with George LeBay, but not, as I've said, about my terrible ride home on New Year's morning, and made it as clear as I could that on no account should she simply cut him off. That would drive him into a fury, and these days when Arnie was furious with someone, unpleasant things happened to them.
That makes it like cheating on him, she said.
I know, I said, more sharply than I had intended. I don't like it, but I don't want that car rolling again.
So?
And I shook my head. In truth, I was starting to feel like Prince Hamlet, delaying and delaying. I knew what had to be done, of course. Christine had to be destroyed. Lee and I had looked into ways of doing it. The first idea had been Lee's, Molotov cocktails. We would, she said, fill some wine bottles with gasoline, take them to the Cunningham house in the early morning hours, light the wicks. Wicks? What wicks? I asked. Kotex ought to do just fine, she answered promptly, causing me to wonder again about her high-cheekboned forebearers, and toss them in through Christine's windows.
What if the windows are rolled up and the doors are locked? I asked her. That's the way it's apt to be, you know.
She looked at me as if I was a total drip.
Are you saying, she asked, that the idea of firebombing Arnie's car is okay, but you've got moral scruples about breaking some glass?
No, I said, but Who's going to get close enough to her to break the glass with a hammer, Lee? You?
She looked at me, biting at her soft lower lip. She said nothing. The next idea had been mine. Dynamite. Lee thought about it and shook her head.
I could get it without too much sweat, I think, I said. I still saw Brad Jeffries from time to time, and Brad still worked for Penn DOT, and Penn DOT had enough dynamite to put Three Rivers Stadium on the moon. I thought that maybe I could borrow the right key without Brad knowing I had borrowed it. He had a way of getting tanked up when the Penguins were on the tube. Borrow the key to the explosive shed during the third period of one game, I thought, and return it to his ring in the third period of another. The chance that he would be wanting explosives in January and thus realize his key was missing was small indeed. It was a deception, another betrayal, but it was a way to end things.
No, she said.
Why not? To me, dynamite seemed to offer the kind of utter finality the situation demanded.
Because Arnie keeps it parked in his driveway now. Do you really want to send shrapnel flying all over a suburban neighborhood? Risking a piece of flying glass cutting off some little kid's head?
I winced. I hadn't thought of that. But now that she mentioned it, the image seemed sharp and clear and hideous. And that got me thinking about other things. Lighting a bundle of dynamite with your cigarillo and then tossing it overhand at the object you wanted to destroy, that might look okay on the Saturday afternoon westerns they showed on Channel 2. But in real life there were blasting caps and contact points to deal with. Still, I held on to the idea as long as I could. If we did it at night?
Still pretty dangerous, she said. And you know it, too. It's all over your face.
A long, long pause.
What about the crusher at Darnell's? She asked finally.
Same basic objection as before, I said. Who gets to drive her down there? You, me, or Arnie? And that was where matters still stood. What was it today? I asked her.
He wanted me to go out with him tonight, she said. Bowling this time.
In previous days it had been the movies, out for dinner, over to watch TV at his house, proposed study dates. Christine figured in all of them as the mode of transport.
He's getting ugly about it, and I'm running out of excuses. If we're going to do something, we ought to do it soon.
I nodded. Failure to find a satisfactory method was one thing. The other thing holding us back had been my leg. Now, the cast was off, and although I was on stern doctor's orders to use my crutches, I had tested the left leg without them. There was some pain, but not as much as I had feared. Those things, yeah, but mostly, there had been us, discovering each other, and although it's going to sound stinking, I guess I ought to add something else if this is going to stay straight. And I promised myself when I began to tell the tale that I'd stop if I found I couldn't get it straight or keep it straight. The spice of danger had added something to what I felt for her, and I think to what she felt for me. He was my best friend, but there was still a dirty, senseless attraction in the idea that we were seeing each other behind his back. I felt that each time I drew her into my arms, each time my hand slipped over the firm swelling of her breasts. The sneaking around. Can you tell me why that should have an attraction? But it did. For the first time in my life, I had fallen for a girl. I had slipped before, but this time I had taken the grand head-over-heels tumble. And I loved it. I loved her. That constant sense of betrayal, though, that was a snake-like thing. Both a shame and a crazy sort of goad. We could tell each other, and we did, that we were keeping our mouths shut to protect our families and ourselves. That was true. But it wasn't all, Lee, was it? No. It wasn't all. In one way, nothing worse could have happened. Love slows down reaction time. It mutes the sense of danger. My conversation with George LeBay was 12 long days in the past, and thinking about the things he had said, and worse, the things he had suggested, no longer raised the hair on the back of my neck. The same was true, or not true, of the few times I talked with Arnie, or glimpsed him in the halls. In a strange way, we seemed to be back in September and October again, when we had grown apart simply because Arnie was so busy. When we did talk, he seemed pleasant enough, although the gray eyes behind his specs were cool. I waited for a wailing Regina or a distraught Michael to call me on the phone with the news that Arnie had finally stopped toying with them and had given up the idea of college in the fall for certain. That didn't happen. And it was from Motormouth himself, our guidance counselor, that I heard Arnie had taken home a lot of literature on the University of Pennsylvania, Drew University, and Penn State. Those were the schools Lee was most interested in. I knew it, and Arnie knew it, too. Two nights earlier, I had happened to overhear my mother and my sister Ellie in the kitchen. "Why doesn't Arnie ever come over anymore, Mom?" Ellie asked. "Did he and Dennis have a fight?" "No, honey," my mother answered. "I don't think so. But when friends get older, sometimes they grow apart." "That's never going to happen to me," Ellie said, with all the awesome conviction of the just-turned 15. I sat in the other room, wondering if maybe that was really all it was. Hallucination brought on by my long stay in the hospital, as LeBay had suggested, and a simple growing apart, a developing space between two childhood friends. I could see a certain logic to it, even down to my fixation on Christine, the wedge that had come between us. It ignored the hard facts, but it was comfortable. To believe such a thing would allow Lee and me to pursue our ordinary lives, to get involved in school activities, to do a little extra cramming for the scholastic achievement tests in March, and, of course, to jump into each other's arms as soon as her parents or mine left the room. To neck like what we were, which was a couple of horny teenagers, totally infatuated with each other. Those things lulled me. Lulled us both. We had been careful, as careful, in fact, as adulterers instead of a couple of kids. But today the cast had come off. Today I had been able to use the keys to my duster again instead of just looking at them. And on an impulse, I had called Lee up and asked her if she'd like to go out to the world-famous Colonel's with me for a little of his world-famous crunchy style. She had been delighted. So maybe you see how our attention waned, how we became the smallest bit indiscreet. We sat in the parking lot, the duster's engine running so we could have some heat, and we talked about putting an end to that old and infinitely clever she-monster like a couple of children playing cowboys. Neither of us saw Christine when she pulled up behind us. "He's buckling down for a long siege, if that's what it takes," I said.
"What?"
"The colleges he applied to. Hasn't it hit you yet?"
"I guess not," she said, mystified.
"They're the schools you're most interested in," I said patiently. She looked at me. I looked back, trying to smile, not making it. "All right," I said. "Let's go over it one more time. Molotov cocktails are out. Dynamite looks risky, but in a pinch..." Lee's harsh gasp stopped me right there. That, and the expression of startled horror on her face. She was staring out through the windshield, eyes wide, mouth open. I turned in that direction, and what I saw was so stunning that for a moment I was immobilized, too. Arnie was standing in front of my duster. He had parked directly behind us and gone in to get his chicken without realizing who it was. And why should he? It was nearly dark, and one splashed and muddy four-year-old duster looks pretty much like another. He had gone in, had gotten his chow, had come out again, and stared right in through the windshield at Lee and me, sitting close together, our arms around each other, looking deep into each other's eyes, as the poets say. Nothing but a coincidence. A grisly, hideous coincidence. Except that even now a part of my mind is coldly convinced that it was Christine, that even at that turn, Christine led him there. There was a long, frozen moment. A little moan escaped Lee's throat. Arnie stood not quite halfway across the small parking lot, dressed in his high school jacket, faded jeans, boots. A plaid scarf was tied around his throat. The collar of his jacket was turned up, and its black wings framed a face that was slowly twisting from an expression of sick incredulity into a pallid grimace of hate.
The red-and-white striped bag with the colonel's smiling face on it slipped out of one of his gloved hands and thumped into the packed snow of the parking lot.
"Dennis," Lee whispered. "Dennis, oh my God."
He began to run. I thought he was coming to the car, probably to haul me out or work me over. I could see myself hopping feebly around on my not-so-good leg under the parking lot lights that had just come on while Arnie, whose life I had saved all those years going back to kindergarten, beat the living Jesus out of me. He ran, his mouth twisted down in a snarl I had seen before. But not on his face. It was LeBay's face now. He didn't stop at my car. Instead, he ran right past. I twisted around, and that was when I saw Christine. I got my door open and began to struggle out, grabbing onto the roof gutter for support. The cold numbed my fingers almost at once. "Dennis, no!" Lee cried. I got on my feet just as Arnie raked open Christine's door. "Arnie!" I shouted. "Hey, man!" His head jerked up. His eyes were wide and blank and glaring. A line of spittle was working its way down from one corner of his mouth. Christine's grill seemed to be snarling, too. He raised both fists and shook them at me.
"You shitter!" His voice was high and cracked. "Have her! You deserve her! She's shit! You're both shit! Have each other! You won't for long!"
People had come to the plate glass windows of the Kentucky Fried Chicken and the neighboring Kowloon Express to see what was going on. "Arnie, let's talk, man." He jumped in the car and slammed her door. Christine's engine screamed, and her headlights came on, the glaring white eyes of my dream pinning me like a bug on a card. And over them, behind the glass, was Arnie's terrible face, the face of a devil sick of sin. That face, both hateful and haunted, has lived in my dreams ever since. Then the face was gone. It was replaced by a skull. A grinning death's head. Lee uttered a high, piercing scream. She had turned around to look, so I knew that it wasn't just my imagination. She had seen it, too. Christine roared forward, her rear tires spinning snow back. She didn't come for the duster, but for me. I think his intention was to grind me to jelly between his car and mine. It was only my bad left leg that saved me. It buckled, and I fell back inside my duster, bumping my right hip on the wheel and honking the horn. A cold wave of wind buffeted my face. Christine's bright red flank passed within 3 feet of me. She roared down the takeout joint's in-drive and shot onto JFK Drive without slowing, rear end fishtailing. Then she was gone, still accelerating. I looked at the snow and could see the fresh zigzag treads of her tires. She had missed my open door by no more than 3 inches. Lee was crying. I pulled my left leg into the car with my hands, slammed the door, and held her. Her arms groped for me blindly, and then grasped with panicky tightness.
It wasn't...
Shh, Lee, never mind. Don't think about it.
That wasn't Arnie driving that car. It was a dead person. It was a dead person.
It was LeBay, I said. And now that it had happened, I felt a kind of eerie calm, instead of the trembly, close-call reaction I should have had, that and the guilt of finally being discovered with my best friend's girl. "It was him, Lee. You just met Roland D. LeBay." She wept, crying out her fear and shock and horror, holding on to me. I was glad to have her. My left leg throbbed dully. I looked up into the rearview mirror at the empty slot where Christine had been. Now that it had happened, it seemed to me that any other conclusion would have been impossible. The peace of the last 2 weeks, the simple joy of having Lee on my side, all of that now seemed to be the unnatural thing, the false thing. As false as the phony war between Hitler's conquest of Poland and the Wehrmacht's rolling assault on France. And I began to see the end of things. How it would be. She looked up at me, her cheeks wet.
"What now, Dennis? What do we do now?"
"Now we end it."
"How? What do you mean?"
Speaking more to myself than to her, I said, "He needs an alibi. We have to be ready when he goes away. The garage,
Darnell's. I'm going to trap it in there, try to kill it.
Dennis, what are you talking about?
He'll leave town, I said. Don't you see? All of the people Christine has killed, they make a ring around Arnie. He'll know that. He'll get Arnie out of town again.
LeBay, you mean?
I nodded, and Lee shuddered. We have to kill it. You know that.
But how? Please, Dennis, how are you going to do it?
And at last, I had an idea. Chapter 48. Preparations. I dropped Lee off at her house and told her to call me if she saw Christine cruising around.
What are you going to do, come over here with a flamethrower?
A bazooka, I said, and we both started to laugh hysterically.
Nuke the 58! Nuke the 58!
Lee yelled, and we got laughing again.